Take me on a trip upon your magic swirling ship. My senses have been stripped. My hands can't feel to grip. My toes too numb to step. Wait only for my boot heels to be wandering.
Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This year, if you can believe it, marks the 125th anniversary of Columbia Records. And this hour we'll be looking at a history of that label, which really is a reflection of American history in many ways as well, because music and history go together, music frequently commenting on history or reflecting history. Sean Wilentz is our guest. He's a professor of history at Princeton University, and he is the author of Bob Dylan in America. We have talked to him about that book. His new book is absolutely beautiful, and what a task to do 125 years of music. It is 360 Sound, the Columbia Records Story, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. We also will be hearing a great deal of music during the course of this hour, which should be great fun. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Sean. Nice to talk to you again.
Kathleen, as ever, it's great to be here.
What a huge project this was, Sean. 125 years of music.
I was nuts. I had no idea what it was going to be. Truthfully, I signed to do it in July 2011, so I didn't know time to do it, right? They wanted a 30,000-word essay, basically, to go with all these pictures. And I said, well, you know, 30,000, all right, we'll see. It's just like an extended essay. And I found out with the music alone, I was going to have to up that. And then I got acquainted with all the other things that Columbia had done over these past 125 years. I mean, it's one thing to have been the recording label of, Al Jolson, Bessie Smith, Benny Goodman, Count Basie, Frank Sinatra, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, Miles Davis. But they also did these other things. They invented the LP in 1948. They were involved in all sorts of other technical changes that really affected the way the recorded music sounded and the way it was consumed. They invented cover art. I mean, they invented so much. So that the history of Columbia, in effect, became the history of the entire recording industry from its very beginning until now, which some people might think is its very end. And to weave all those things together, it was a challenge. And, you know, I knew from the start, and I say this in the beginning, I knew I wasn't going to be able to cover anything, everything, or even the things I was going to cover were going to have to be covered quickly. But so this is kind of an outline more than anything else. But I hope it gives readers at least a sense of the extraordinary accomplishments that this company has had over the years.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sean, know that you were appreciated, and I thought of you every moment I was reading all of this. I kept thinking, Sean did a lot of work on this.
That's nice to hear. I did do a lot of work. It was a lot of fun.
I imagine.
I didn't have much time, and I wasn't going to go through all. I didn't do what I would do if it was a regular history book. I couldn't do the archival research. It would have been daunting. I couldn't interview anybody because if you interview one person, you have to interview everybody.
Right.
I interviewed a few people, but it was very special. And so I had to find things out really quickly. But it turns out there was a fair amount around in the way of memoirs and they do have they did give me access to catalogs and all kinds of stuff that actually made the job a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that struck me when I was talking about this at our dinner table last night was my husband looked at me and said, 125 years, what in the world were we listening to 125 years ago? What? I didn't even know we had something that we could play music on.
Right, right. Well, we had the graphophones. We had the early phonographs, which were cylinders, right? People collect these. You see them around still. Wax cylinders, basically, on which the sounds were inscribed. People had to record them. Recording artists had to record them one by one, so that every single cylinder was a unique performance. You can imagine how tedious that was for the recording artist. That changed fairly quickly, but still, for about 10 years or so, people had to do that. The artists, remember, America was a very musical culture, and it always has been. And at the end of the 19th century, you know, it wasn't that people didn't have music. They had plenty of music. There was lots of music around. It was very amateur. You know, people had their parlor pianos, and you'd go hear the band at the village bandstand and all the rest of it. So that there was not too much of a line, really, between performers and listeners when recorded music came in, because there was a world of amateur performance. So some of Columbia's very, very, very early acts included a guy who was known as the Whistling Patrolman of Washington, D.C. They were based in Washington, D.C. at the time. Yodeling was very big. Very big yodeling.
Great.
Because the technology was so primitive that you had to have a very sharp sound, a very almost shrill sound, as in the case of the whistle. And those were important. It also helps explain why Columbia's first really important musical act was the Marine Band, then under the direction of John Philip Sousa.
Oh, and let's hear some of that. This is the Washington Post March, first recorded in 1890. What's the background to that, Sean?
Well, the Marine Band was in Washington, as was the company at first. That's why it's called Columbia Records. It's named after District of Columbia. And Sousa had really reinvigorated not just the Marine Band, but all of that kind of military marching music. He gave it the word then was pep. You know, you had peppy rhythms and peppy stuff. So it was becoming very popular. And the people at Columbia had the idea of trying to get the Marine Band recorded, and they did some very quick and rapid and many, many recordings at once. The thing was, however, given the technology, you couldn't record the entire Marine Band. What you're hearing there, it sounds very nice, but you're hearing only about 16, maybe 20 tops of the Marine Band members. There was also a problem in that John Philip Sousa hated recorded music.
Really?
Yeah. He thought it was going to he was going to weaken the national throat, and it was going to take away from precisely that amateur performance that he found so important. So he refused actually to participate in the recordings. He was happy to let his men make an extra buck a session because they were on military pay is not that much. He was happy to help them out, but he didn't want anything to do with it. So he wasn't actually in the recording studio, which was built across from where the Marine Band was billeted in Washington. He'd have an assistant do it, but without question, his name was so attached to the Marine Band that in some ways, even though he hated it, he became the first great recording star of Columbia Records. You know, go figure.
Isn't that interesting that we've always worried about, first we worried about recorded music because of live music, then we worried about the radio. There's always been something, right?
Well, that's it, and the history of recorded music. The recording music industry has had a very, very volatile history because the technology always does change. And so that when the radio came in, for example, in the early 20s, and the radio stations start up, everybody, it would be very hard. You would hard put to find somebody who thought that the record industry could survive that. Because after all, you know, people are going to buy a radio. Then what do I have to buy all these records for? They can get all the music they want for free.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a real fear, and indeed, at the very beginning, phonograph sales and phonograph record sales really did decline precipitously. But then they realized what happened was that recording artists would appear on the radio, and then people would want to go out and buy their records. So it was more mutually reinforcing than it was a matter of one undoing the other. But still, the fear, the panic was palpable, and you can even read it in the accounts of the time.
Mm-hmm. We're going to go all over the place with this. We can't really do it chronologically because we got phone calls coming, so we're going to hear different artists who were signed to Columbia and talk about classical and jazz and Beyonce. We are even. I promise we'll play Beyonce sometime during the course of this hour. I've never done that before on public radio. But let's welcome phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. And Chris in Madison is our first caller for you, Sean. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. Sounds like it's going to be pretty darn interesting. I call it because years ago I read Kitty Kelly's infamous biography of Frank Sinatra.
Mm-hmm.
And it talked a little bit about his time with Columbia, which I think was when he was recording with the Dorsey Brothers. And what really rocked me is that even though that ended, I think, around 1950, when he started with Capitol Records, they said that his royalties averaged $1 million a year from Columbia. And I was wondering if that's possible. And also, I was kind of surprised to learn that I think his producer was Mitch Miller. Mm-hmm. Both singing along with Mitch, and he sounded like he could be pretty fierce when he was in a position of authority there.
Oh, you've got a couple great things that we'll talk about. Let's hear a little bit of Sinatra. This is from, and then we'll hear the story because Sean writes about it pretty extensively in the book. This is Sinatra from 1948, one of my favorite songs.
I've got a crush on you, sweetie pie, all the day and night time, hear me sigh. I never had the least notion that I could fall with such emotion.
Oh, the Bobby Soxers must have been screaming when he sang that.
Frankie!
He just started making a whole lot of money in a short period of time, didn't he?
Yes. Well, not so much from the records. I don't know, Chris, whether he actually made $1 million from his Columbia recordings, but on his appearances. It's funny, when he first broke into Columbia, he had actually left the Tommy Dorsey band and went solo, and that's when he signed with Columbia. But, you know, he was in the beginnings of a strike. There was a musician strike that lasted a couple of years, a musician strike, rather. The musicians weren't playing on the records. So he'd have to record with, you know, backup singers, the Bobby Tucker singers, backing him up, sounding like musical instruments, going, you know, like bop 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 bop, and that was the instrumentation. So it was a little weird. So they used all these old recordings from Harry James in particular, when he sang with Harry James, and brought those back out and reissued them and made that. Those are the things that raced up the charts. But he was also making a lot of money in personal appearances in New York and L.A. And, you know, he could command his price went up in the space of a year, went up, I don't know, fivefold, sixfold. The figure is in the book. So he's making a lot of money, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about a few of the other stars. Have big names been what sustained the record label?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, people at the top always, you know, pull the rest along. You know, so that a Sinatra, but, you know, going back, you know, the gigantic star, the first really gigantic star I suppose they had was Al Jolson.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were earlier Burt Williams. There were some earlier ones, but Jolson was a sensation. And you know, the economics of the industry is such that, much like publishing, much like records, you know, until the very recent past, you'd always have your big stars, and they'd allow you to record, you know, fairly obscure people that you wanted to have on the label for prestige reasons, or, you know, it allowed you to do the classical music line, allowed you to do jazz for a long time,
which is great.
70s. So that's what would happen, yeah, and Columbia had those stars. Every record company has that model. It's part of the business model of what they do, or had it anyway for a long time.
Now, you because of your writing in this book, got me to reexamine my thoughts about Al Jolson. I just thought, you know, doing this blackface, it was a pretty racist kind of thing.
Right.
Tell me why I should think about him differently.
Well, I mean, blackface has a long history. And actually, my colleague Dave Marsh has a wonderful little sidebar on blacking up. It goes back to the very very early years, early decades of the 19th century. But as it's evolved, by the time you get to Jolson at the 1910s and into the 1920s, the form has evolved. So under Jolson in particular, it's lost a lot of its racist connotations. I mean, you know, obviously not entirely. Anytime a white guy is corking up and trying to look like a black man, it necessarily assumes,
right.
You know, racism. But he's not acting out as a racist. In fact, Jolson was ended up being one of the most the firmest advocates of integration in the recording industry and on Broadway of anybody. I mean, he was really quite a liberal about all of this stuff. But the form had evolved so that it became a way in which a white performer could act out in ways that the sentimental balladeers could not. You know, if you wanted to sing what he wanted to sing, If you did it in blackface, I kind of gave you a license to do it, permission to do it. So, and he did that. That's what it was about. And when you listen to him, I mean, listen to a Jolson song without looking at it, right? Everybody, many people have seen the jazz singer, and they see Jolson, and they know what he looks like. But if you listen to him do his blackface material, he's not singing in that derisive, you know, darky dialect. He's not making fun of black people. There's none of that in his music.
Well, let's listen to him. Al Jolson from 1920.
I've been away from you a long time. I never thought I'd miss you so. Somehow I feel your love is real. Near you I want to be. The birds are singing, it is song time. The banjo's running.
Al Jolson with Swanee. We welcome more phone calls. This hour of the program, we're talking about 360 Sound, the Columbia Records story. Columbia celebrating its 125th anniversary this year. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. There are great stories to come on Bob Dylan, of course, great jazz performers, Tony Bennett, Barbara Streisand, Simon and Garfunkel, a big label stars for the record label in the 1960s. We'll hear more of that and talk more about the history with Sean Wilentz in a moment. 800-486-8655 for you to join us. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Miles Davis, Columbia, 1959, Kind of Blue, the name of that song. I have to admire them for keeping jazz alive. Jazz was important. It obviously wasn't a huge moneymaker for them. And also classical music, Sean.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, jazz was became a moneymaker, funnily enough, when Miles Davis wasn't so much Kind of Blue, which is, you know, commonly regarded as the greatest modern jazz album ever, certainly the most popular. But Bitches Brew, his album from 1969, actually was his first, I think it was his first gold record.
Mm.
But Miles Davis made money for the label. But yes, jazz went from being, you know, the major form of popular music in the swing era, Benny Goodman and Count Basie, both Columbia recording artists. But then when Sinatra comes along and Tony Bennett come along, jazz, pop takes over and jazz kind of gets effaced. And, however, for a very, very long time, all the way through Wynton Marsalis in the 1980s, Columbia kept its commitment to jazz, in part because of its, a particular person named George Avakian, who was their great jazz figure. You know, he just was dedicated to it, and they were never going to, you couldn't imagine Columbia without Avakian. But also they had this idea that they wanted to, you know, be in as many different genres as they could, and jazz had always been important to them, and there was great work being done. That begins to fade. You know, Miles is there, and Thelonious Monk they signed up in sort of the second half of his career. And Dave Brubeck, one can't forget Dave Brubeck.
Oh yes, love
Time
Dave
Out.
Brubeck.
Mm-hmm. And so it's all there, but it begins to fade so much. Brubeck's sales decline. He's no longer on the label. It's not going to be what it was until you get to the, you know, point you are today, where, I mean, almost there are some very, very good jazz players on Columbia, but not anywhere near as many of them. And most of the people you've heard about, from Wynton to, I don't know, Herbie Hancock, they have their own, they're either recording on one of the independents like Blue Note, or they have their own labels. Then there's classical music, which, of course, at the beginning of the once you get past the Whistlers and Yodelers stage,
sorry to have missed that.
Yeah. Well, but then even before electronic music, electronic recording in the 20s, classical music is very important. One has to remember that Enrico Caruso was the rock star of the 19 aughts and teens.
I mean, mm-hmm.
And in part that was because there were a lot of Italian immigrants around, but that's where it was at.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, Columbia did not get to record Enrico Caruso, but they recorded many of the stars from the Metropolitan Opera. They imported from England. Their English branch sent them things from, you know, Thomas Beecham and the great English orchestras and orchestra, you know, all great conductors. So classical music was always at the heart of the program. And continued to be right through Leonard Bernstein.
Yeah, let's hear a little bit of Leonard Bernstein. I just think he was a genius. He did so much to bring terrific music to all kinds of audiences. And, you know, just West Side Story alone is a life worth living. This is Leonard Bernstein in the New York Philharmonic playing Charles Ives Symphony No. 2. It was recorded for Columbia in 1958. Don't you think he was a genius, Leonard Bernstein, Sean?
And Charles Ives, too.
Yes.
But yes, no question, Kathleen, that what Bernstein did, and this is very much part of the ethos of the label, he was able to introduce people to great music. He himself wrote in many different forms. He could write Broadway musicals. He could write his own mass. He could write his own, you know, high music. He kind of collapsed the distinction between high and low. And that was something that Columbia was very interested in, particularly the man who was running first the classical division, then the label itself, a man named Goddard Lieberson, who was a very, very important character, and he and Bernstein were close.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the other thing is that, that's a recording. I'm glad you did that one, actually, Kathleen, because in just that period when Bernstein's coming in, American composed music became very, very much a part of the label's presentation. It had been very European-oriented before. But you get Charles Ives, you get Aaron Copland, you get Leonard Bernstein. They are now being brought front and center, very much on the same level as all the great European masters.
Hmm. And what I was watching Jeopardy this week, and one of the questions was the best-selling album, and I can't remember the year right now, and I think the answer was West Side Story.
West Side Story did extremely well. The original cast album was on the bestseller list. The exact number is in the book. At that point, now, I remember this as a kid. Certainly remember West Side Story, but my parents, in their record collections, would have these best-selling records. The real core of all that was the Broadway musical.
Mm-hmm.
The Broadway musical, of which Bernstein obviously got involved, but it came out right about the time that the LP was invented in 1948. So that one of the first big LP smash hits was the original cast recording of South Pacific with...
Oh, yes.
Azio Pinza.
I love that film.
Mary Martin,
mm-hmm.
all of that. And it's a, you know, well, you love it, you see. But that's in part because it was made available. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
And so from Sound of Music right through to, I don't know, Annie and on into the 70s, Columbia did a great job of being really the number one label for those original cast recordings. Some Sondheim. Going on back to Bernstein.
Sean Mullins is our guest, and he's written the history, really, of Columbia Records, 360 Sound. It's a beautiful book. It's also filled with lovely pictures and album covers and great history of music and Columbia from many, many years ago. Our number, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Kay in Black River Falls. Hi, Kay.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about the old-time radio shows you have on weekends. A lot of times they have from the Columbia Broadcasting System, which is CBS.
Right.
And I was wondering if it's the same thing or if that's a different company.
Very good question. Columbia existed as independent of Columbia Broadcasting. There was a slight connection in the late 20s when CBS, the broadcasting company, was started up. But in 1938, the Columbia Broadcasting System bought the consortium of recording companies that Columbia Records was a part of. It's called the American Record Company. And the guy who ran CBS, a very important figure named William Paley,
decided when he bought all of those labels that he was going to collapse them all into Columbia. He had this affection for Columbia, not surprisingly, given the name of his broadcasting system. So from 1938 until 1988, really, for 50 years, Columbia Records was part of CBS Incorporated. It was part of the radio station, and Paley made very sure to make sure, you know, to have Columbia Records recording artists on his radio shows. He was cashing in on all that.
Let's talk about a couple of the other big names that were signed and that have been with Columbia for years and years and years. Barbara Streisand, Tony Bennett. Holy Toledo, has he been singing for years or what?
Yeah, I just heard Tony at his birthday. They had a big birthday celebration about a year ago, and he was on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera House, and he sang a cappella, Fly Me to the Moon, and he flew us to the moon.
Mm.
And he's 85 years old.
He's been
with the label since 1950. When Sinatra had a big dust up with Columbia and took off in the early 50s, and you know, fortunately, Tony Bennett was on the scene to pick up on that kind of, you know, pop standard, beautiful sound.
Tony Bennett.
The loveliness of Paris seems somehow sadly gay. The glory that was Rome is of another day. I've been terribly alone and forgotten in Manhattan. I'm going home to my city by the bay. I left my heart in
Tony Bennett in 1962, and we want to play a little more because his career has been so long. He's done these great duets. Can you, let's hear a little bit of Tony Bennett and Amy Winehouse, and then we will talk to you about his career with Columbia.
Sure.
Again, here's Tony Bennett and Amy Winehouse.
That you turn away romance, so
are you pretending it looks like the ending? Unless I can have one more chance for birthday.
How does somebody stay around for so many years and with a label for such a long period of time, Sean?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, he's obviously a force of nature.
Mm-hmm.
The label part, though, actually, he was tossed off the label. That tells you something about what can happen. I mean, in the mid-70s, Clive Davis was running the company then and was a big rock and roll. He made Columbia the big rock and roll, biggest rock and roll label in the world. Bennett was out of fashion. He was kind of going nowhere, and then he actually had some personal difficulties. He was off the label for a while, into the 80s when he came back via Columbia. So there was an interruption. Nevertheless, you know, the two were very closely associated. It was Columbia Records that really got him going in 1950. And it is extraordinary, though, that how many artists there are who have been on Columbia for a very long time. I mean, he's the grand old man, to be sure, although the word old and Tony Bennett don't necessarily go together because he's ageless. But Barbara Streisand's been on the label since 1962. Bob Dylan was signed in 1961, first album in 1962. These are long-term. Bruce Springsteen's been on the label since the mid-1970s. It's very rare for performers to stay on a label for that long. But to have that many great stars stay on the same label for all of that time is really unprecedented.
Mm-hmm. We have to hear some Barbara Streisand. Can we go to her? This is Barbara Streisand from 62. Happy days are here again.
Howdy, gay times. Cloudy, gray times. You are now a thing.
Sean, do you know the story of how she was discovered?
Well, I mean, Barbara Streisand was a very, what should we say, active. She was active. She played summer stock. She was very ambitious and diligent. I mean, she got gigs anywhere she could, and she sang wherever she could. And she was singing, and she got a break on Broadway. That was her first big break, in a show called I Can Get It For You Wholesale. And she played. I actually saw this as a kid.
Did you really?
Yeah. I was just barely old enough. It was 1961.
Oh.
And I was 10. And she played she had a role called Miss Marmalstein. And she kind of stopped the show with that. She was 19 years old. Mm. She stopped the show. But she was also still playing at her clubs. She had boundless energy. So she would finish up on Broadway and then go to one. There were two clubs in particular. One was the Bonsoir down in the Village, and then a place called the Blue Angel, which was 55th Street, I think. It was in the 50s, not too far away from Broadway. And it was at the Blue Angel that Guider Lieberson, the head of Columbia Records, heard her, didn't think she had already heard her in the Village, and he didn't think she was a Columbia artist at all. Her sound was too big. It was too much. She could be a cabaret singer, but not a Columbia recording artist, which then was more in the crooning style, female crooning style of somebody like Rosemary Clooney.
Oh, sure.
Right. So, you know, this didn't fit. But then he heard her again up in at the Blue Angel, and he had to admit, he went to her manager, a remarkable man who's still very much going, named Marty Ehrlichman, and said, look, I made a mistake. I want to record Barbara. And so they did. Starting off, they tried to record it live in the Bonsoir. That didn't work out, so they went to the studio, and that's what you heard.
Mm-hmm. We got to go to rock and roll. I can't believe we've gone this far without rock and roll, but obviously 125 years is a lot of years. At what point did Columbia, was it the success of the Beatles? When did they realize that something different was happening and they had to latch on to some rock and roll stars, and how did they decide who they were going to latch on to?
Yeah. Well, you know, they were very slow. I mean, they resisted. Most of the majors did, but Columbia in particular. Mitch Miller, who had been the guy who brought Tony Bennett in, and you know, Chris was talking about earlier, the sing-along gang, he didn't like rock and roll. So that, you know, they had a chance to sign Elvis Presley and Buddy Holly, and they passed
on. Oh,
they
man.
They didn't put up enough money. But, you know, and also Columbia was an album company. So, you know, rock and roll was a 45 genre.
Mm-hmm.
It had all kind of come together. By the mid-60s, they're sort of getting it. Some of their subsidiary labels have released. Screaming Jay Hawkins was on OK Records, which was a Columbia label. but really not much is happening. The British Invasion had passed by everybody except Capitol, MGM. They're all on subsidiary, second, third tier labels. So Columbia does start to play around with it, but Bob Dylan was central to all of it, almost. They do sign Paul Revere and the Raiders, a much underestimated band, actually, I think. They're thought of for all their antics on TV and Dick Clark's shows and where the action is and so forth. Now, there were those ridiculous, you know,
right.
You know, they're like members of the Tea Party or something. Yeah. you know, tricorn hats, they're kind of silly too. You know, they were the response to the British Invasion, right? They were the Paul Revere and the Raiders. But boy, they were a great band, and they recorded some great songs, some of which are I talk about in the book. But then it was, you know, it was the Byrds. Well, they were playing Bob Dylan songs. You know, a Mr. Tambourine Band,
sure.
The first big hit. Then Simon and Garfunkel, they originally record their the song "The Sounds of Silence," "The Sound of Silence," rather, straight out folk style. And then a producer, Tom Wilson, puts on sort of a rock arrangement, becomes a huge hit. Well, Tom Wilson was Bob Dylan's producer, and the guys he used were Bob Dylan's session men. And Dylan was already beginning to move into playing electric, quote unquote. And then Dylan, of course, does do all of that, and like a Rolling Stone, gets to be number two, I think, in the charts. I mean, it becomes, in some ways, Columbia's biggest, fastest hit, or one of them, anyway. And from then on, things are going to change. The real shift happened, though, in 1967, when the man I mentioned earlier, Clive Davis, who's one of the outsized geniuses of Columbia's history, went to the Monterey Pop Festival in California and heard this band called Big Brother and the Holding Company.
Oh, Janis.
And that changed his life profoundly. You know, and it wasn't just them. I mean, it was the whole scene, really. I mean, it was Summer of Love. It was Haight-Ashbury. It was just down the coast. And he was just blown away by all of it. So they did sign Big Brother. And then from there on in, really, Davis makes Columbia into the premier rock
label in the world, in part with San Francisco bands or Bay Area bands, Santana, but not just, you know, just across the board. And they have a great ear for all kinds of, you know, it's not just hard rock and roll, but, I mean, Billy Joel comes on the label.
All right, wait, we got to go back and hear some of this. You're moving us into all these artists we want to hear. Let's hear a little bit from Simon and Garfunkel. We have an email question about this, too. This is from 1966, the song you were talking about.
And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking. People hearing.
And an email, Sean, from Kurt in Poinette, who has in front of him a 33 and a third LP titled Simon and Garfunkel on the Pickwick label. What's the story of Columbia Records going after them?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the Pickwick label. I can't. I'm going to have to look at my own notes to remember what that was all about. But Columbia signs them. They originally were a duo in Queens, and they had a hit with a song called Hey Schoolgirl in the 50s. On, I think it was called the Big Hit Label, actually. But they come in 1964, and Columbia signs them to an album, to a recording contract, and they record an album called Wednesday Morning 3 a.m., which is a straight folk album. They were down in the village. They were looking for the next Bob Dylan, and there was Simon and Garfunkel. And it got nowhere, you know, kind of bombed. You know, so they moved to England. I think they'd actually split up at that point. And Paul.
Yes, that's what you write.
Yeah, Paul went to England, and Garfunkel stayed in the States. And they thought, well, that didn't work out. But college radio stations, I think in Boston and then also in Florida, pick up on one track from that album. It's called it's called The Sound of Silence, and it's a really big hit.
Mm-hmm.
People love that song. It was a straight. It was not the version that you played, Kathleen. It was a straight. Folky version, and you get that album and you can hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Tom Wilson had the idea of really you can build on this swelling tide by putting rock musicians on it. So they dubbed in the rock musicians that you heard, and the thing became a gigantic hit.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought Paul Simon back very they got him on the next boat or the next plane. And they got him in the studio, and they recorded another album called The Sounds of Silence. And that was their first big, you know, really
yeah,
big album
that.
On Columbia. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't remember the Pickwick. I somewhere in my notes, but hold on to it, I would say. It's a collector's item.
Yeah, I'm sure. Here's another big hit. You mentioned Big Brother and the Holding Company, and this is the unforgettable Janis Joplin. She had a tragic story, didn't she? Oh, my.
But every time I hear that song, I get goosebumps.
I know, don't you? It just goes right through you.
I was sitting here, you didn't see me. I was pumping my fist. I love that song. But, yeah, it's a sad, horrible, terrible story.
Yeah.
This great talent. Well, Billie Holiday had the same kind of problems. I mean, they're enormous. She used to say that she would get out on stage and, you know, she'd have her Southern Comfort and she'd make love to 10,000 people every night and then go every night go home alone.
Mm-hmm.
And she went home, and indeed she ended up, you know, overdosing.
Yeah.
She was part of the burnout. But, man, what a talent. I mean, she brought to that whole Haight-Ashbury scene, which was, you know, the Dead and the Jefferson Airplane, and, you know, that kind of sound. She brought, you know, Port Arthur, Texas into that. And, it's a sound that I think is going to last for a very, very long time.
Yeah. We'll take more phone calls in a moment, and here's the number for you to join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We want to play as much music as we can, so before we go to our pause and our action, let's hear a little bit of, what do you think? Where should we go? Let's
what
go
do you got?
Bruce. Let's go to Bruce.
All right, we'll go to Bruce.
Here's Bruce.
Thank you. quicker than to calm his shaking hand and tried to tell himself at last he had become a man. A dusty cowpoke at his side began to lap him down, and he heard again his mother's words: "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your..."
Johnny Cash, a Columbia artist as well, "Don't Take Your Guns to Town" from 1968, his first record with Columbia. We have a caller who wants to talk about Johnny Cash. Larry in Whitehall is joining our conversation with Sean Willens, author of the Columbia Records story, 360 Sound. Hi, Larry.
Hey, Larry.
Hi. This is a little fun little anecdote about when Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan were recording Nashville Skyline. I was going to school in Nashville, and ABC Television had just passed around free tickets to come down to the first recording of the Johnny Cash show.
Uh-huh.
Which Bob Dylan was a guest on. So
right.
we all got in line and ran down there. Anyway, I think it was the next morning, a songwriter friend of mine, Stephen Allen Davis, asked if I wanted to go down to Columbia and watch some of the recording.
Wow.
Of Nashville Skyline. So,
wow.
So we all jumped in a car and ran down there and waited up, I guess it was the sound room where the boards are. Mm-hmm. And Johnny Cash and the studio musicians were all set up, and Dylan didn't show up. And finally he did, and he came in and got his guitar out and started playing, muttered something to Johnny Cash, and they started singing Girl of the North Country.
Oh, I love that song.
If you ever listen to the recording, you'll hear that Cash and Dylan's phrasing is different. It's like they had never practiced the song together.
Right.
They start and stop phrases at different times.
Right.
And it almost sounds amateurish, but every time I hear it, I'm kind of charmed all over again, and brings me back to that day.
What a terrific memory, Sean.
What a wonderful story, guys.
Yeah, isn't it?
Well, but Bob Dylan and Cash had an interesting history even before that, because Cash was always an admirer of Dylan. I mean, I have a Louisiana Hayride recording of him and June Carter doing "It Ain't Me, Babe" very, very early on.
Mm-hmm.
And when Dylan was, you know, Dylan would periodically get people angry at him because his music was either getting too personal and then rock and roll and all the rest of it. And Cash was one of his great defenders all throughout. He said, "Look, he is a genius. Let him sing. Just let him sing." And There's a story that Bob Neuwirth tells of I think it was at Newport and Newport Folk Festival, and at one point Cash, they barely met. Cash gave Dylan his guitar, and that in country music is a sign of the ultimate homage. And here is Johnny Cash, who was, you know, by then a huge deal in country music, and who Dylan had listened to when he was a youngster up in Hibbing. Giving this guy his guitar, that probably meant as much to Dylan as anything could have.
Thank you so much, Larry, for the call. Let's move to some modern music. This hour is going too fast. I promise, I've been promising all morning that when else in my public radio career am I going to be able to say, "Here's Beyonce"? So we're in a place of Beyonce.
All right.
Yeah, okay, here she is.
Come and look at some crazy right now, your love's coming, look at some crazy right now. Come and look at some crazy right now, your touch, come and look at some crazy right now. Come and open your page right now, your kiss, come and open your savior right now. Look, you're so crazy, your love's coming, look at so crazy.
Beyonce and Crazy in Love, 2003. How did she become such a big star for Columbia?
Well,
Sean,
she became a big star because she's Beyonce. That's what she made herself. But she was in a band. She was in a group, you know, which many of your listeners remember, called Destiny's Child, which came out of Texas, and it was it went through some permutations. But Beyonce Knowles was always at the center of it, as was her dad, who was behind the scenes. And they became, I guess, the closest thing to the Supremes, Diana Ross and the Supremes. But in a couple of decades later, And then Beyonce. Then they all went their separate ways, and Beyonce sort of became like Diana Ross. I mean, if there's a Diana Ross of successor story, it's definitely Beyonce.
Mm-hmm.
And Columbia recorded Destiny's Child, and she stayed with Columbia ever since.
Mm. And there's an amazing picture of her in the book. She must be terrific at yoga because she's got her body in like this pretzel position.
You know, Kathleen, I got to say, I think that every picture of Beyonce is pretty amazing. I think that, you know, just there are just a few people like that.
I think you're right. Well, let's go to a call. Mark in Quito. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. I have a question about the age of 27 with rock stars. Why can't they get past it? You look at Kurt Cobain and Janis Joplin.
Yeah. Jimmy
there
Hendrix.
Were so many of them.
Yeah.
They should maybe take a year off when they turn 27. And then
I'm laughing to keep from crying, but yeah, I know what you mean. Well, you know, the burnout was big, and you know, one time, you know, Jim Morrison and Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix, you know, the day the music died, all of that. A lot happened there. That had to do with the 60s. But, you know, there's still a, creativity and clinical depression and drug use, heavy drug use as medication, mm-hmm. They still go together, and you're still going to get that. I don't know what there is about 27, but I think that's right. Maybe if they just... If it went directly from 26 to 28, you'd be okay. I don't think rehab quite works that way, though, but that's what it often is. I mean, mm-hmm. all of these people. And poor Janis. I mean, getting back to her. You know, when you realize now, I mean, I'm an old man, right? And you know, that she was doing all that at age 27. It's extraordinary to me.
One genre we haven't talked about very much, and I don't listen to that much, although I do appreciate some of it. Let's hear a little bit of, well, you can tell us about this group. This is, what year? We got 2006, and Columbia and country. How strong was their association with country?
Oh,
the Dixie Chicks, Long Way Around from 2006. Did Columbia champion country music?
Absolutely, from the very start. I mean, the 20s are already recording, along with the blues, they're recording what was called hillbilly music. Bands like Gid Tanner and the Skillet Lickers and Charlie Poole, who's a very important figure in modern American music, banjo player. So they're doing it very early on. They had two men, Don Law and Art Satterley, who were A&R men, both British actually, who were adept at getting all kinds of country acts. So, from Patsy Montana through Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys, on into Roy Acuff. I mean, I can go on and on. I can read like the Country Music Hall of Fame. Johnny Cash, of course, and then into the, you know, all the way to the Dixie Chicks. Columbia had a studio down in Nashville. Has a very strong connection. It's somewhat a decline as country music has become something other than what it was. But yeah, no, it's a very, very important current in the whole history of the label.
Sean, is anybody putting together at least a sampling of these songs? It makes me want to have a CD.
Oh yes, no. There are many different versions of this book.
Oh.
There's the book that you've got, but
all right.
There's a deluxe edition.
Yeah.
And if you go on Amazon, you can find it. And this is where my friend and collaborator, really, in all of this, Dave Marsh, who's a very distinguished rock critic, he put together a flash drive, a little flash drive.
Oh yeah.
With 263 of the greatest tracks that Columbia ever did,
very nice,
including spoken word tracks. And then he wrote a book that goes along with it that gives his quite brilliant and pithy discussions, commentary on each of the songs. So you can buy all of these things together and, you know, spend your whole day, weekend, week just in Columbia Records.
Or you're, in your case, the whole last couple of years. Sean,
well,
you're always so much fun. Write something else. Thank you so much for being with us.
I can't wait to be back here, kiddo.
Thanks. All right. Sean Wilentz. It's 360 Sound, the Columbia Records story. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for producing this. A lot of music went into this particular show, and thanks everybody for your calls and for listening. This is the Ideas Network, and we go out with Billy Howdy.
I can't get along without you.